Something happens in childhood when kids are exposed to chronic stressors, and that is that the brain and the body and even the epigenetic expression of our DNA change in response to unpredictable stress.
You are listening to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. This is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. Hogg Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation that is based at the University of Texas at Austin. To find out more about our grant programs, visit www.hogg.utexas.edu. Into the Fold is the Hogg Foundation's now 15-episode-long experiment into broadening the conversation around mental health issues. And we hope that with the first set of episodes that we have done, that we have taken at least a modest step toward achieving that goal. As always, you can find us on iTunes U. Just do a search for Into the Fold, and please let us know what you think. With us today is Donna Jackson Nakazawa. She is the author of the just published Childhood Disrupted, How Your Biography Becomes Your Biology, and How You Can Heal. It's, in a nutshell, a self-help book that is framed around the most current understandings about adverse childhood experiences. And so she's here with us today to expound upon her research into this area and its implications for the health professions. And so, Donna, thanks so much for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure's ours. just to start, what was it that was your impetus for diving into this area, and what spurred your interest in it?
Well, for me, really everything I do is something of a marriage between the personal and the professional. So as a science health journalist, I've spent really the last dozen years exploring the intersection between budding neuroscience, our growing understanding of human immunology, and how these scientific discoveries affect what I think of really as the deepest inner workings of the human heart. And certainly as I've explored these interconnections in science for others, it's reflected in exploration on behalf of my own well-being and those who are closest to me.
Okay. And just based on my own occluded view of the field, it seems almost as if the trauma is sort of, having its moment as an area of concern. And so one question that I have is just what it is exactly that your work contributes to the conversation that's novel, even for those who are pretty well versed in it.
Well, I think that one of the things we understand about the over 1,500 studies that have been done on research in between adverse childhood experiences, or what are also commonly referred to as toxic childhood stressors, and adult health and disease, one of the things we're understanding is that although we accept that the idea that physical trauma or sexual trauma in childhood would understandably be related to later adult health disorders in terms of psychiatric disorders, mood disorders, depression, anxiety, that makes total sense to us. But what this research is really exploring is something much more, and that is the relationship between types of stressors that we might think of as less acute and less in it less overt and less obvious, that are more emotional stressors, the kind of stressors that happen in childhood that are sometimes fairly common, such as growing up with a parent who suffers from a mental health disorder, a parent who is addicted to alcohol or another substance, growing up with parents who bicker a great deal and a divorce, losing a parent to death or for other reasons. And one of the most noted relationships between early childhood toxic stress and later adult health disorders is growing up with chronic humiliation or put downs in one's own living room by a parent or caregiver. And so this idea that emotional stress is related to later disease is a new idea in this way for two reasons. One, we can see from these 1500 peer-reviewed studies that the relationship between even more common stressors and adult disease plays itself out on a physical level. So what do I mean by that? Well, something happens in childhood when kids are exposed to chronic stressors, and that is that the brain and the body and even the epigenetic expression of our DNA change in response to unpredictable stress. So what we see through this large body of research is that whatever the stressor is in childhood that's happening, when it is chronic and unpredictable, a child's brain goes on red alert. They never know when the next moment of high stress is coming, where they're going to have to be in fight or flight or freeze state. And that changes the way that the developing brain it responds to the world around it, shifting the immunologic response for life so that we have a much greater likelihood of developing disease in adulthood on a physical level. So I can delve into that really deeply and in as much as you want, in terms of how that changes our DNA, how it changes the size and shape of the brain, how it changes the interconnections between areas of the brain that we rely on a daily basis for how we respond to the world. So this is a really new body of research. It tells us that when children face chronic unpredictable stress, no matter the reason, it translates into biophysical changes that predispose us to disease in adulthood on a physical and epigenetic level.
And so if we're talking epidemiologically, so to speak, what would you say are some systemic changes that, like over the near term or the medium term, could kind of help to, in a sense, inoculate, future generations against, the various phenomenon that you describe?
Well, I think first we have to really have a much greater understanding of this research. Right now, the statistic of how many healthcare practitioners are aware of this information is about 20%. So we're talking about a type of gene-environment interaction. Again, early unpredictable chronic toxic stress in childhood and the likelihood of later adult physical disease that is so profound, it's not unlike the link between smoking and cancer. And yet, healthcare professionals have, by and large, in adult medicine, turned a blind eye to this. It is really being better understood in pediatric circles, and in the criminal, justice system. But adult medicine practitioners really have not delved into this research about the biological changes that occur in the face of chronic unpredictable stress and how that affects adult individuals and their health trajectory and health outcome in adulthood. So I would say that awareness is one of the most key things that we can do. But that awareness is also really important on a personal and individual level. And I cannot tell you the number of times that I've given a talk about this or a presentation, and the kind of aha that individuals have who feel that for many years they've been swimming against a seemingly impossible tide. They understand that they have a slew of chronic conditions, physical and perhaps emotional. And it just, life seems very hard. And when they hear this information that they experienced different chronic unpredictable stressors or ACEs in childhood, that these change the way in which their DNA sets the stress response for life, or what we call epigenetic changes, and that sets their immune system on a high inflammatory response for life. It begins to make so much sense to them, and that begins to be the moment of change and understanding. So let's just talk a little bit about numbers. The original study on adverse childhood experiences was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, looked at 17,000 individuals. And among those 17,000 individuals who were middle-aged, largely middle class, 64% of them had experienced at least one category of adverse childhood experiences. Again, these categories include the emotional neglect and physical abuse, sexual abuse, growing up with someone who humiliated you, growing up with a parent who was addicted to something, growing up with a parent who suffered a mental health disorder, or losing a parent to divorce or other reasons. Those were some of the categories. So 64% of Americans had experienced one or more. 40% had experienced two or more. So what did that mean for them? Well, the number of ACEs that a patient had faced before the age of 18 predicted how much medical care they would require in adulthood. For someone with four categories of adverse childhood experiences, they were twice as likely to be diagnosed with cancer. Women have a particularly acute relationship between adverse childhood experiences and adult health disease. And I write about that a great deal in my book. The relationship between the female immune system and stress is particularly interesting. So, for each category of adverse childhood experiences that a woman had experienced, her chance of developing an autoimmune disease as an adult woman, and an autoimmune disease so serious that she would require hospitalization, increased by 20%. So let's say, just to put this in real terms, that a woman grew up before she turned 18, her parents divorced, her mother was chronically humiliating her, putting her down, and her dad was an alcoholic. She would have an ACE score of 3. That ACE score of 3 would increase her chances of developing an autoimmune disease as an adult woman by 60%. So these are pretty staggering numbers. Similar links exist between ACEs and heart disease and a whole range of chronic illnesses, from migraines to fibromyalgia to irritable bowel syndrome. So when you ask about inoculating the future generation, it's a complex answer because without awareness, we have very little chance. And so I would argue for awareness both in the medical community and also on an individual level.
Okay, and so how did you go about finding, the people whose stories, make up, much of the meat of your narrative in the book?
Well, I started with really talking to about 100 individuals who had come to me. Of course, Childhood Disrupted is not my first book as a science journalist. Before that, I had written The Last Best Cure, and before that, The Autoimmune Epidemic. So I have a large readership that reaches out to me with stories and questions, and a really lovely group of individuals who I often think of as having been really tremendously courageous survivors. They have a great deal of fortitude. They're searching for wellness, and they often have been living with chronic conditions for some time. So, as I began to talk about my interest in writing Childhood Disrupted, I really heard from a lot of people, and I began conversations with quite a few of them. I started with about 25 individuals and eventually narrowed it down to 13, the reason being that it was so important to me to tell not just stories of suffering, but to also talk about the ways in which people had begun to heal. The stories of healing were as important to me as the stories of adversity. And all of the people I was talking to were engaged in a healing journey. Some were further along than others. And I wanted the reader to come out of the book. As you know, a good half of the book is really about different healing modalities and approaches in the science of healing the body and brain despite a history of trauma. And I wanted stories that reflected that truth so that people could hit the ground running when they put the book down and not be left in a place of information alone. I think it's really important to have the information about not only how we change in terms of our DNA, our epigenetics, our cells, our brain architecture, our synapses, but how we can change back and become who it is we were really meant to be and evince a better self through a story of early chronic adversity into a lifetime of having something more through this journey and coming away with a deeper sense of compassion, a deeper sense of understanding about ourselves and our families and the world we live in. That to me is the full story. I didn't want to tell just half the story, so I was very careful to look at individuals who could help me tell the whole story.
And so, just out of curiosity, do you have any kids?
I do. I have two children and three dogs.
Okay. And I realize that, trying to translate what it is that you know philosophically or, psychosocially into your day-to-day interactions with actual people, much less your own children. That gets to be kind of complicated, but I was just wondering how your own parenting or approach to relating to your kids has been altered or impacted or informed by, by your wide readings in this area.
Well, so do you have children? I just want to know first.
I do not, no.
Okay.
Haven't had that pleasure.
Yeah, right. So my children are 16 and 20. My son is a junior in college, and my daughter is a junior in high school. And so I feel a lot of compassion for parents as they read this book. And I talk a lot throughout the book about not blaming oneself for all those inevitable moments of parenting where you said or did the wrong thing, because there is no such thing as perfect parenting. We all have moments where, our 16-year-old son is on the computer for an hour when he said he'd take out the trash, and the third time you ask him, you kind of flip your lid because you just can't believe that that a video game is more important than helping out. So we all have those moments, and this isn't really about that. This isn't really about those inevitable moments when we're not good parents. Anyone who is a parent knows that you can become almost neurotic worrying about the consequences of every act and every thought and everything that you omit from the parenting toolbox. So that said, I really was careful throughout the book to make sure that parents know that the particular types of stress that we're talking about here, these are toxic stressors that happen in an environment in which the stress is repeated. It is a secret. In other words, it is not spoken about. So let's say the issue is that there's a great deal of financial stress, or someone in the family is suffering a chronic illness. that whatever is happening is not a secret because kids code secrets as being about them. We all know the famous divorce stories in which kids blame themselves for their parents' divorce, even though it has nothing to do with them. So let's bear in mind that toxic stress in childhood is chronic. It doesn't go away. It's a secret, so the kids don't have an understanding of it. They can't frame it and name it and therefore unpack it. And what we understand is the most protective factor in childhood against chronic, unpredictable toxic stress is having an adult who is consistently there for a child is the most protective factor. So the thing that I like to tell parents among all the different strategies that I present in an entire chapter in the book is that the most important thing is that there is a consistent adult who is there for that child come what may and is there to discuss whatever chronic stressor is going on and offer unconditional love. So that is a really important thing that parents need to understand. This is not about the moment when you said, damn it, take out the trash. I can't rely on you, can I? And then you go in and you apologize. This is about stress, ongoing stressors that are secret and not discussed, and it can be mitigated in a number of ways. One, always apologize. If you do say or do the wrong thing, take a moment and apologize. Say, hey, you know what? I kind of flipped out on you and I'm really sorry about that. And that was wrong. You still have to take out the trash. You can still set boundaries. But I'm sorry that I did that in that way. That had to scare you. And you know what? We can see in scientific studies that when parents apologize to kids, the amygdala, which really lights up when kids are afraid, that stops lighting up. The brain calms down, the immune system calms down. And let me just talk a little bit about why chronic unpredictable stress with a parent is so damaging. So the way the immune system responds to stress, think about meeting a bear in the woods. You see the bear, you go into fight or flight. Every hair on your body stands up, the blood flows away from your stomach. That's why you get butterflies and feel nauseous, because right then all the energy has to go into your arms and legs. And so then the bear kind of looks at you, shrugs, walks away. Whew, your body relaxes. You go back into a sense of homeostasis, you're relaxed, you go on with hiking in the woods. Well, think of a child for whom that bear is coming in the house every night, and they don't know. Dad came in from the bar. Is he going to get out his belt buckle and give me a whack because he thinks I said or did the wrong thing? Or is he going to go to his room and go to bed? That sense of not knowing, of chronic unpredictable stress, keeps the brain in a state of fight or flight so that it overproduces stress hormones that change the function of genes that will set the stress response for life. So, researchers at Yale recently found that kids who were in chronically stressful situations as children, they showed changes in all 23 chromosomes, including genes that help to oversee the stress response and in genes that are linked to the likelihood of developing a range of chronic diseases in adulthood. So, some of the different ways that we can prevent kids from being in that state of chronic stress is to remember something really key, and that is that when kids are afraid of their parent and what their parent is going to do, it puts them in a very difficult position because who is their caregiver? Their parent. If their parent is scaring them, who is the person they want to run to when they're scared? Their parent. But if their parent is scaring them, who do they also need to run away from? Their parent. Biologically, we cannot run towards someone and away from someone at the same time. And that creates a freeze state in a parent, in a child's brain that can cause them to disassociate and bring down some of the neural connections in the brain that are really important. So when I say that there are simple practices to help keep that from happening. These are really, really important simple practices. The fact that they're easy to do should not negate the degree of importance that they have in parenting. So, like I said, a simple apology, other things that become really, really important are bringing in the good to a child's life, really helping them to build the neural structure for taking in the good, stopping and having moments in which you say, wow, look at the sun fluttering in those trees. Let's just stop a minute here and take that in. Or, wow, we're eating this delicious piece of chocolate. Isn't it good? Or, hey, look at how the sun is coming through the clouds as we drive over the water on the bridge. I'm just going to drive a little bit more slowly because I'm really enjoying being in this moment with you and looking at this beautiful day. So building the neural structure for what's good is also really important in parenting. And there are a number of other things that I offer up in the book.
Well, Donna, you've given us plenty to chew on, and so I think that you've done a service, not only, to those of us here in the world of mental health who, consider themselves to be pretty hip to these issues, but also just the broader, conversation around what's best for kids. And so thanks so much for finding the time to talk to us.
I really appreciate you taking the time to ask me. And I guess I would say to parents, the more you learn to regulate your own behavior as a parent, the more you'll be able to provide your kids with what they need to feel safe. So a lot of the work of being a better parent is to learn to manage your own stuff. And I think that really begins with an honest conversation about your own history and your own trauma and how you've dealt with it and how you're healing. So I would love to make sure that we leave your listeners with that.